to First Fuel, a fortnightly podcast bringing you perspectives on the role of energy efficiency, energy management and demand response in the energy transition taking place in Australia and around the world. I'm Luke Menzel, CEO of the Energy Efficiency Council, and this week I'm joined by two First Fuel regulars to kick off 2021. Frankie Muscovich is National Policy Manager for Sustainability and Regulatory Affairs at the Property Council of Australia. Welcome, Frankie.
Thanks, Luke. Thanks for having me back.
And Tennant Reid is the lead on energy, environment and climate policy at Australian Industry Group. G'day, Tennant.
Glad to be back here as well.
Well, here we are in 2021, and while it's clear COVID-19 will continue to dominate the conversation in terms of politics, public health and the economy, it is also shaping up as a pretty interesting year for climate and energy. So today the three of us are going to do a bit of thinking out loud about the things that are going to shape the conversation in that space. And I wanted to start with what was, for my money, the biggest and most significant shift globally over the last month or so in the transition to the Biden administration, who, as expected, are taking a pretty different tack on energy and climate issues as compared to the previous administration. Tennant, the executive orders have been flying thick and fast, but with a razor-thin Senate majority and a rolling health and economic crisis, what are your early impressions of the Biden presidency and what it might mean for energy and climate policy in the US, but also around the world?
So my number one takeaway is that climate is really a big theme of the administration. It's not just that they've assembled a narrow team to handle the climate stuff, but that the administration is stacked, in fact, with climate hawks, and they're weaving climate into almost everything that they're doing, which is quite surprising given the many challenges that they're confronting, the many other things that they also need to focus on. There's a big role for climate, not just in Environment Protection Agency regulation and in the big investments that they were talking about during the campaign, but in the work of the financial regulators, the work of the National Energy Commission, the FERC. Across the board, there's stuff happening on this front. And as you say, the numbers in the Congress and, for that matter, the courts, the courts will be responding in time to this initial wave of executive orders. Everything that anybody does in America is subject to a lawsuit, and we will see how that constraint plays out. But it's big and it's broad-based, and it's a surprise, I think, to us in Australia, where by and large, climate change policy is, a matter for the climate change minister and can struggle to get on the agenda of the rest of government.
It's certainly the case that for those that won't get about this stuff, we're very conscious that a whole of government approach is really essential. And when it comes to, an effective climate change initiative from government, it is really notable and I think interesting that the Biden administration seems to have taken that to heart and is looking from day one to ensure that there is that clear coordination across all those areas of government. And I suppose, Frankie, we can think about all the things that the administration has on the agenda in terms of the economy and the health challenge. There's a degree to which concern around climate is actually being integrated even into the recovery effort of the administration. And as we said in our previous episode, when we focused in for a whole sort of 60 minutes or so on what was going on in the US, the Biden administration really putting energy efficiency but a clean recovery more broadly at the heart of its stimulus agenda.
No, absolutely. And just, on the whole of government approach here, if you think about the Biden administration's top set of priorities, across the board, they've been severely impacted by the pandemic, not just from a health perspective, but the flow-on economic consequences of that. They've also prioritised climate in both a foreign policy and domestic policy context, as well as, I think the the very high-profile issue of racial inequality and the Black Lives Matter movement. So it's been, I think for Australian observers, quite astounding to see, some of the things that Biden's come up with, which is to, one, put jobs and a focus on jobs in clean energy and climate at the very heart of the economic recovery and response to the pandemic. But he's also, directed all federal agencies to identify new opportunities for innovation, commercialization, deployment of clean energy technologies and infrastructure. He's obviously working with his special climate envoy, John Kerry, and a domestic equivalent as well. But the other thing, and I just wanted to touch on the racial inequality piece as well before circling back to the economic recovery, he's established an environmental justice interagency council to address the racial and economic inequalities exacerbated by climate change. So not only is he focusing on, jobs that could be created to aid economic recovery through things like clean energy and energy efficiency, and we'll come back to that, he's further making sure that money, or at least a substantial proportion of it, gets directed to disadvantaged communities as well. So it's, it's a pretty impressive cross-cutting agenda that we're seeing. But probably the biggest thing I'd remark on, if we're wanting to compare and contrast against the approach, say, that the Australian government's taken with its economic recovery package, is, the very intentional way that Biden is looking to deploy that stimulus funding into areas that we know are very job rich in the energy space. So I know we've probably talked about this ad nauseum, but the IEA's report on a sustainable recovery released last year, really set out that things like retrofitting or building new buildings to high energy standards is incredibly, labour intensive, and we're talking about employing tradies and small businesses that often spend money within their local area, stimulating local jobs. And, there's a supply chain impact from, creating demand for stuff and appliances and the like. So, he's recognised that buildings retrofits, and indeed he's got a strong focus on government buildings and really seeking to improve the efficiency of government operations, also because it saves them money. So that's a big focus. And he's also obviously highlighted opportunities to accelerate the transition in the energy sector, which in the US they've put a target for net zero, I think, by 2035. So that's quite an aggressive timeframe, especially when you consider the amount of oil and gas, that the US have historically relied on. So not so much of an emphasis on a gas-led recovery, say, in the US. I think that's a pretty clear contrast with the Australian government's approach, but very much focused on the kinds of actions in the energy sector that have, proven out to create the most jobs, sort of per $1 million invested.
On my summer break, Frankie, I worked my way through President Obama's memoir, and it was fascinating reading his accounts of particularly that intense period in early 2009 when they were framing up the stimulus legislation post-global financial crisis, or indeed in the midst of the global financial crisis. And it was clear that he was incredibly proud about the degree to which they focused on clean energy and energy efficiency and the like. And to some degree, you can argue, notwithstanding, a whole bunch of regulatory work that happened over the course of the presidency in terms of utilising the levers that the EPA had at its disposal and the like, that some of the big wins that the Obama administration was able to achieve in terms of that clean energy agenda were really secured in those first couple of months of his presidency by ensuring that they were embedded in that that stimulus package. And you can see the Biden administration in almost learning those lessons and building on them. There's a sense in which they're getting the band back together and facing a situation which is not entirely dissimilar to the one that Obama faced back in 2009, going, well, what went well? What would we do differently if we had our time again? And certainly it's significant that those clean energy elements, those stimulus elements focused on the transition are figuring even more largely in the plans in 2021. Tennant, did you have anything you wanted to add to any of that?
Yeah, just 2 points of extra interest out of all that. The racial justice and environmental justice intersection within the Biden administration arises in part, or the degree of emphasis arises in part, because they've faced some blowback and some resistance from the environmental justice community to some of their personnel choices or options and some of their directions. It was widely believed that Biden's first choice for leading the Environment Protection Agency and a lot of the key regulatory steps that they're going to be taken had to be set aside because she was too associated with carbon pricing in California, and the partisan and political valence of carbon pricing is quite different in the United States to what it is here. The left regards carbon pricing as something that is bad for the disadvantaged in the US, where it's seen as grubbly centrist and if not conservative.
Oh, for some grubby centrism, Tennant.
Well, we get a lot of references to the sensible centre, and that might be a very productive place to be. The other thing is that, if memory serves, 12 years ago in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the Obama-era economic rescue package, there was something in the order of $20 billion for the clean recovery, clean economy efforts within that, which at the time was seen as a lot, and led to the highs of fostering the survival of Tesla and the lows of backing Solyndra and a lot of stuff that was pretty good. The commitment on the campaign trail this time, we'll see what actually emerges out of the Congress, but the commitment was $1.7 trillion US over the next decade for investment in clean economy and climate change. So they've learned some lessons, and one of them seems to be go big or go home.
And I did want to spend some time on the implications of the Biden administration for the multilateral landscape when it comes to energy and climate globally. Obviously, we've got a lot of attention on the upcoming COP in Glasgow in November, but Tennant, I note that there are a bunch of multilateral events that are taking place over the next 10 months or so in the lead up to Glasgow, many of which have a strong climate focus, and it strikes me that there's almost the potential for there to be a bit of a drumbeat heading into Glasgow of these issues being discussed and potentially ambition being ramped up, momentum being developed ahead of the next conference of parties.
Yeah, so it's definitely going to keep coming up. Every year there is a calendar of major international events. 2020, a bit unusual in that regard, and there's always the potential for climate and energy to be a big deal in one or another of those. This year is looking unusually focused on that. So we've got coming up on April the 22nd, an international heads of government climate summit convened by Biden. It was one of his campaign commitments to do this, where he will be both bringing the US back firmly into the international conversation on climate and pushing other governments to lift their commitments. Then in June, the G7 will be meeting in England, and the UK, as host of the Conference of the Parties later this year, have control of the agenda for this G7 meeting. They've nominated climate as one of the top four issues that they'll be pushing on, and their number one focus is higher ambition, more statements. And then we've also got the G20 meeting in Rome in, I think, September, where Italy is the co-organiser of the COP this year. They're playing a supporting role in the UK, and they are probably going to put it high on the agenda as well. So all of that means the issue isn't going away. It doesn't guarantee that outcomes are going to be reached or that what's printed on the page will be especially meaningful, but it's got a higher chance of being meaningful than usual. And it's certainly going to be, I should add, of course, at the G7 meeting, Australia is a guest. The Prime Minister is invited to that meeting, which is not usually the case with the G7. And we are a long-standing member of the G20. And I think we've got an invite to April 22nd, or at least a hoping for one. So it's going to be a busy year on either the broadband or the air miles for Australia's diplomats and our leaders. And we need both. We need a good story well told at all of those meetings.
And Tennant, for those of us that spent a lot of time on the beach and a bit fuzzy on the details of the significance of Glasgow after a long summer, can you remind us what's on the agenda in Glasgow and why it's so significant?
So there are a few things that are important here. One is this is going to be the first COP since the Paris Agreement officially commenced. So it feels like a little while since the Paris Agreement was struck, but it was to commence from 2020, and we haven't had a COP in 2020. It's also shaping up as a really key point for the process that Paris established. The whole core of the value of the Paris Agreement is in this ratcheting process of ambition. Everybody knew when Paris was struck that the initial offers of emissions reductions that all the nations were making were not going to be enough to achieve the stated goal that we all share of keeping the rising global temperatures to well below 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees. Everybody was going to keep coming back with updates to their best offer and to increase and bootstrap their mutual level of ambition over time. So the Glasgow COP is the first real push for that process to commence. It's about lifting ambition for 2030, lifting ambition for the medium term beyond that, and cementing more ambition for 2050. And that's an enormous focus of the UK government and what they will be using all of their diplomatic heft and their push, Boris Johnson's push to establish the UK as an independent world player post-Brexit, centres on that this year. And then finally, it is also the opportunity to finish filling in the rules for a couple of pieces of the Paris rulebook, especially the rules around international collaboration on emissions reduction through what's called Article 6, which relates to both market approaches, like setting up a descendant of the Clean Development Mechanism to generate international offsets, but also rules for how countries like Australia and economies like Europe might collaborate through linkages of policies, or more to the point, how we might collaborate with countries like Indonesia or our Pacific Island neighbours on helping them to reduce emissions in addition to what we are able to reduce domestically.
So just a couple of things on the agenda, Tennant.
Well, having witnessed negotiations on Article 6 fail at the last two COPs, I hope they will succeed this time, but there's some very difficult issues in there, and that's probably easier than. No, actually, I'm going to change my opinion in mid-flight. I think it is harder to agree those market rules than it is for countries to just say more ambitious things that they reckon they can do. Although a lot of them have said they could do more if those market rules are agreed in ways that are workable. So there is a connection between them, but we're more likely to emerge from the end of the year with a lot more commitments to targets than we are to get one big trading scheme.
Well, Frankie, I think from all of that, we can say confidently that you know, the Prime Minister and various Australian ministers are going to be sitting around various big tables over the course of 2021, being asked questions about what Australia's position is on climate and mitigation and ambition and the like. How do you think this sort of dramatically shifting international context is going to feed through into the political landscape here in Australia, noting, of course, that we are seeing some evolving language from the Prime Minister on the topic of net zero emissions, noting as well that we're in an election year, so anything that is done by both sides of politics, to be frank, will have a weather eye on the prospects of influencing that important date.
That's right. So we're already starting to see this play out in the language used by the federal government, particularly the Prime Minister. Everyone widely suspects that we'll go to a federal election towards the end of the year. Now, the timing on that is not certain, but if you were Scott Morrison and you get to the end of the financial year and some of those tax breaks, you know, from last year start to flow through to the pockets of Australians around the country, and assume that our vaccination program is running on time and the majority of Australians have had a vaccine administered to them by October as they're targeting. It starts to look like a pretty attractive proposition to go to the polls when you're riding the wave of some of that success and potentially some of the economic stimulus we've seen the government roll out over the last year, the impacts of that dropping off, you know, potentially starting to be a little bit more evident. So all of the markers point to something happening at the end of the year. Anyone who watches the language of political leaders closely could not fail to mark the, I think it's been called widely, a crab walk slowly towards a more firm commitment around net zero by the Prime Minister at his National Press Club address at the start of the week, where he said, we'd like to get to net zero emissions as quickly as possible, preferably by 2050. And I think he said, or maybe sooner, you know, if the technology provides for that. Even that slight tweak of language was very significant to anyone who follows, you know, that the language employed by political leaders around climate. So the combination of we're probably heading to a federal election around the end of the year, and that timing coinciding with all of those international events that Tennant spoke about means that climate is very likely to be a top-tier election issue this year. So I think the opportunity is there's a ready-made process that is already underway, looking at what is the long-term strategy that we would present for Australia in a 2050 context, and potentially looking at any prospect of increasing ambition on a 2030 or a 2035 horizon. So there's an opportunity to make that process a little more ambitious than we might have imagined a year ago. Now the foundation for that, I think, as we've seen also in language from the Prime Minister, but also Angus Taylor, is, you know, it's still very much going to be grounded in their technology focus and the key product of that being the technology roadmap. But there is still, there is still an opportunity for them to take a more holistic view on pulling in, other key, I think, sectoral approaches, where there has been some really good policy work done over the last couple of years. So that would be my hope, to turn that process into something more ambitious that's leveraging some of the good thinking that's been happening perhaps a little under the radar. And then very finally, I did just want to say, from my early conversations with the federal government in terms of the bureaucracy, the clear message I'm getting is that this government is very much taking notice of the Biden administration and looking at, what might be done to and this is, I would say happening quietly, and perhaps part of this process, how we might align with some of the things that the Biden administration is talking about. So it's a good time to be thinking about energy efficiency. It's a good time to be thinking about, investing in infrastructure, some of the other technology-focused things that this government's already been prioritising. Things like, infrastructure to support green hydrogen and the like. So I think perhaps the next time we might see a better articulation of that is the budget coming up in May.
Oh, obviously, Frankie, it's always a good time to be thinking about energy efficiency, but perhaps particularly in 2021 for the federal government. Tennant, do you agree with Frankie? There's opportunities there. What do you think of the prospects of the federal government taking advantage of them to make a significant shift?
Well, look, the crab walk approach has also been called the boiling frog strategy, which I think is a really fortunate metaphor in the context of climate change policy. Who's the frog here? Is it like Australia?
Also, we're trying to turn the temperature down, right? That's the whole premise of all of this activity.
it is clearly happening that there is this step-by-step evolution of language, and policy evolution is also happening, but is a bit less evident. But if we look at the directions that energy policy is going, there's a lot of stuff said on all sides of politics about energy policy. But if you just look at where the big dollars are going, it is to facilitate the entry of larger amounts of renewable energy and to digest the closure of old coal-fired power stations.
Mm.
Well beyond the retirement of Liddell over the next couple of years. So there is that change happening. What hasn't happened really so far, and I'm not sure whether policy is going to be able to get to it this year in an election year. I think that focus on the argument over headline objectives may be occupy more of our time. But the gap between the sorts of things that ARENA is able to fund, so direct government grants, co-investment with industry in stuff that is far enough out of the lab that you can do a pilot project or a demonstration or go from zero to one, and the sorts of things that the Clean Energy Finance Corporation can loan to, which are either near commercial or commercial in their own right, between those two things, there is a world of what that is going to make a technology that is a real thing investable to get to the point where it's large and the costs are coming down fast enough for it to be commercial. Now, in other areas, in other parts of the world, this has been accomplished through things like renewable energy targets or feed-in tariffs or honking big subsidies or regulatory standards or something like that. And now that we're turning the focus of innovation less on the generation of wind and solar, which has got more more innovation to do, but is clearly well along to what are we going to do about all the other bits of the economy that involve emissions? What's going to get stuff to scale? What's going to produce many doublings of installed capacity in hydrogen electrolysis, in zero emissions transport, in the range of industrial technologies that are relevant? Carbon capture and storage is something that needs a bit of a signal from something. So when we're talking about technology, not taxes, I agree that out-and-out carbon taxes and national emissions trading schemes are not on the agenda anymore. Some people can have a quiet cry in the corner about that. Some economists and public policy people last year were meeting with fresh new takes and ideas on more sensible and calm ways of doing carbon pricing. But if we set that aside, there's potentially a lot of other stuff, but if that can be done. But if we're going to call everything that involves any kind of cost a tax, then I'm not sure that we can do anything. It's interesting to note that in the last few months, the federal government, has announced a rescue package for the refining sector. That is intended at shoring up our fuel security, which is a very important subject. And they've proposed to finance that with a 1.5 cent a litre levy on petrol users, which is a big deal. But the objective is important and worth bearing a cost for. And we can argue about the best way to structure that cost, the best way to achieve the objective. But if you want it, you've got to be prepared to pay for it. And so the question that's going to confront the Australian government, but also state governments, which have talked a big talk about climate action, is what are they? What value do they actually place and express on climate outcomes through costs that are willing to be borne? Costs are probably going to wind up being smaller than economic modelling suggests, because modelling's got an absolutely rotten record in this space. But we have to consider the costs of what we're trying to avoid.
Mm. Well, it's about the D word, isn't it? It's about deployment, and that's the of activity that is absolutely essential to get you from that early stage innovation to being commercial and making sense in the market. And it's interesting you raise the states, because I think, you know, at least a couple of states have a much better story to tell on deployment of at least some technologies than the federal government does. I mean, we do have the energy efficiency obligation schemes that manifest as certificate schemes in Victoria and New South Wales, and there's a hell of a lot of work underway in both of those states to think about how they can continue to be evolved over time to drive new technology into the market. And I think the federal government will have some big questions if it is a technology focused approach, if it is about all driving down costs, how that might be achieved absent some mechanism to drive deployment into the market. That's the big gap that I see. What do you reckon, Frankie?
From my perspective, you know, where we've really suffered in having the debate so dominated by the electricity sector and its role, you know, as a very important sector, and indeed other sectors depend on its decarbonisation for their own efforts, is that we've really oversimplified the challenge in a sense in terms of the public discourse. And there are a lot of other sectors in the economy that have very different challenges in meeting a net zero, you know, objective. So if I look at a sector I'm very familiar with in terms of the built environment or infrastructure, it's not a question of technology at all. We have the technology to build net zero emissions buildings today. but there are very persistent, long-standing non-financial barriers that prevent the deployment of such technology. It's about information asymmetry, bounded rationality. Oh, we can have a whole conversation on the theory of change and why that hasn't played out across a really fragmented sector like the built environment, where you've got everyone from, you know, very sophisticated institutional investors, where all the drivers are lining up. Investors want to see change. The tenants of those buildings want to occupy spaces that align with their own, you know, sustainability objectives, and the market has delivered and is working effectively. But it goes all the way down to your mum and dad who own their home, and they have a lot of other things to worry about in their life to figure out what they need to do to make their homes efficient and comfortable. You know, there is not the same information available to them about the performance of their home, the cost-effective things they can do to save money, reduce emissions, all those things. So all of that requires coordinated efforts by every level of government, because the levers, you know, lie all over the place to drive that action. And it requires stability and long-term policy to drive that action. Those things don't happen overnight. So, I mean, that's just one sector, but there are lots of other sectors across the economy that have very different challenges. And so in being caught up in a decade-long, you know, war focused on the electricity sector and the, you know, the merits of solar, wind versus continuing to hold up old coal-fired power stations, we've really missed a lot more nuanced discussion about what needs to happen, you know, when you sort out that sector and the economics are, as tenants says, are dictating that investment is flowing, you know, more to renewables now, and that transition needs to be managed. But the challenge isn't an economic one anymore. Where do we need to direct our efforts elsewhere? So that's the challenge. I think, you know, examples of government sort of stronger intervention in certain sectors, and we talk about, we mentioned the gas-fired recovery before, that you know, it's a very confusing concept for anyone in the building sector. Because this industry is looking to actively transition out of natural gas. And indeed, you know, we haven't seen, I think, the much needed, sensible, objective analysis of, you know, what the cost of propping up existing, you know, gas pipeline infrastructure is versus electrification of buildings. And like, that's the work and the conversation that we need to be having now, because all of that, you know, requires a lot of thought and planning. Again, these are assets that are around for a really long time, and we don't want to see, you know, investment directed in one way or another based on, you know, sort of short-term priorities.
I'm not sure that we're going to see a lot of investment directed as a result of a set of policies at all. Most likely to produce a handful of studies and not much else.
Well, and you know, as you say, it's better to focus on where the money is flowing, and we certainly haven't started to see that, you know, result in any, you know, long-term commitments to large infrastructure generation along those lines.
First Fuel is brought to you by the Energy Efficiency Council, a not-for-profit membership association for businesses, universities, governments, and NGOs. The Council's mission is to unlock the potential of energy efficiency to deliver healthy, comfortable buildings, productive, competitive businesses, and an affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy system for Australia. To find out how your organisation can get involved, visit eec.org.au/membership.
Frankie, we're almost out of time. I want to give you both the opportunity to highlight something either that we haven't spoken about yet that you really want to get off your chest on this first episode of First Fuel for 2021, or indeed something from your sort of policy bailiwick, as it were, that you'll be keeping a close eye on in the energy and climate space that you'd like to alert our listeners to.
Well, Well, I'm going to pick more than one because you've just sparked a few things in my mind, and I want to plant the seeds for, you know, our next appearances on your podcast altogether. So there's a couple of things. From a built environment perspective specifically, there's been a huge amount of work that's been happening over the past few years looking at upgrades to the minimum standards for construction of new buildings. And this year is a pretty critical one to really bed down some of that work for the next revision of the National Construction Code. And those changes are, you know, more squarely focused on residential buildings. In the 2019 code, we saw on average a 35% stringency increase in requirements in terms of energy performance for new commercial buildings. And that was, you know, a pretty significant step up, but that was because we hadn't seen things change in almost a decade. And we're well past that point for homes. You know, I think we're very focused on supporting changes that will see, you know, a good increase to those minimum standards and be putting us on a pathway towards, you know, towards net zero homes by 2030. So that's the building side of things. The other issue, I think we've already touched on it again, is the intersection of buildings with the electricity sector. And as you know, I think electrification is a really hot topic for both my members who are, you know, at this very moment, thinking about how they're going to meet net zero by 2030 or 2025 commitments. And that necessarily, you know, involves a conversation about, one, you know, what they specify for new building construction. So we're certainly seeing a lot of interest in all electric buildings and how that can be done. But also what that looks like for the existing building stock, which is everything that's out there over time. So, you know, I'm really keen to see, you know, a good, robust analysis of what the, you know, what the options are from a technology perspective, you know, across the grid that makes sense for the different classes of buildings. And, you know, we're talking about industrial here as well. So, you know, existing and new commercial, existing and new residential, industrial buildings, I think that transition could look quite different depending on, you know, the profile of energy use in the home, the technology that's available at the moment. I'd really like to see that piece of work done. And very finally, I couldn't, you know, appear on a climate policy-related podcast without noting the current inquiry into Zali Steggall's climate bill. I know Tenen gave evidence, as did we at the Property Council last week. I won't comment on, I don't think, you know, its prospects moving forward, but all of the things that we've talked about today in terms of the missing pieces from the policy landscape in Australia would be better provided for if we had, you know, such a framework in place. So that it's a really, I think, constructive, you know, bill that's been put forward. It's prompting, I think it's sort of helping create momentum, you know, for the conversations that will go on through the year in terms of what we take as a net zero strategy by 2050 to Glasgow.
Well, the downside of going second is I've had too much time to think of many important things that are happening this year. I will just mention gas prices and the policies in the gas-fired recovery suite are going to take a lot of attention from industry and certainly from me and my colleagues this year. The price of gas is recovering in Eastern Australia and in East Asia from the lows of last year. Mm. It's currently looking as if it will go back to being pretty high by recent Australian standards, although not as high as the incredible surge of East Asian gas prices in January this year. That is bubbly, but prices, they look like they're going back to maybe just slightly below where they were expected to be before. that is an ongoing challenge to important parts of heavy industry in Australia and contributes to affordability challenges for other energy users. And what can we do about it is an important question. The government's tried to give an answer. It is looking difficult for those initiatives to have an impact. And we saw in the heads of agreement that the feds struck with the East Coast gas exporters a couple of weeks ago, that they're basically, for all the pre-hood recovery talk, just cementing the pre-existing expectation that Eastern Australian gas prices are going to reflect East Asian netback LNG prices. So that's going to be a focus because for the long term, while electrification and hydrogen and other options may be the transition pathways for industry, in the near term, gas is pretty important to the cost structures of the chemical sector and metals and food processing and much more. The other stuff is, of course, we've got the decisions this year on the future of the national electricity market. The Energy Security Board put out their latest thinking a few weeks ago, and you could describe that in part as surrendering the idea of the price mechanism in the national electricity market driving investment, and an acceptance that state and federal government contracting policies are going to determine what gets built, and the market will just try and optimise around that. But reaching a final agreement on that design evolution this year is going to be a big deal, and getting consensus on something is critical. The ESB would like to try and get some coordination and corralling around these investment policies. That seems like a tall order, but one that is worth trying. Finally, I will say industry transition is going to be on our agenda big time this year. We're a supporter of the Australian Industry Energy Transitions Initiative that leading members like BlueScope Steel and Orica and many other substantial Australian high-emitting sector businesses are a part of, with Climate Works and Climate Kick, and charting the course of not just the technical pathways but the economic pathways and what is needed to make them invest for some of our economically critical and harder to decarbonize sectors beyond electricity generation is going to take a lot of thinking. We also hope to have some work out of a series of workshops that the Climate Roundtable is hosting this year and last year on what successful transition looks like in different sectors and different parts of society. And hopefully mid-year we'll have more to say about that. But definitely looking beyond electricity is going to be important for us all.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose my hope in some ways, not just for this year but for this decade, and you've both spoken to it now, is that we start to, I think the word you used, Frankie, was nuance, a more nuanced conversation around the transition pathways in different parts of the economy and what it means. As you say, Frankie, moving beyond an electricity-focused debate to one that's actually thinking through the different opportunities and barriers in agriculture, in manufacturing, in the building sector, in transport, and particularly the key stakeholder groups that need to be brought on a journey for whom much of the climate debate has been background noise over the last decade. And the only other one that occurs to me is that there is an awful lot of policy activity taking place at the state level. Obviously, we're all waiting with bated breath for the Victorian government's climate targets and sector pledges, which I understand are theoretically coming in the next few months, guys.
that's been the case for about a year.
But I guess we all recognise that the Victorian government's also had a bit on its plate. And so that will be fascinating to see where Victoria lands on that front. But not just in Victoria, but in New South Wales and other jurisdictions, there's a lot of policy work thinking through how they marry net zero aspirations that are commitments pretty much across the board at that subnational level, with actual policy and programs that will allow them to make a contribution to hitting those targets. So a lot of work to do on that front as well. But we are well and truly out of time. I have the strong impression we could talk for another hour, but we won't subject our listeners to that. It is a delight, as always, to catch up with you both, to get your insights at the start of what is shaping up as a really fascinating year. So thank you, Frankie.
Thanks, Luke and Tennant. This is always a lot of fun talking to you both. So looking forward to a rematch.
Thank you, Tennant. I think Frankie's definitely inviting herself back onto the podcast sooner rather than later. So I'll have to invite you again. I'll let my arm be twisted.
And I'm going to have to start taking some more controversial, disagreeable positions. There's too much meeting minds going on here. It won't seem like an Australian energy conversation at all.
Yes, well, you know, it's nice to have a safe space from time to time. Tennant, there's plenty of forums for us to disagree with others in our day jobs. But that brings us to the close of this first episode of First Fuel for 2021. As always, you can find us on Twitter if you have comments. Tennant is at Tennant Reed, Frankie is at Frankie Muscovich, and my handle is at Luke Menzel. And to keep up to date on the latest in energy efficiency, energy management and demand response, you can follow the Energy Efficiency Council at EE Council. If Twitter is not your thing, you can email the team. The address is firstfuel@eec.org.au, and make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to First Fuel in your podcast app of choice. And of course, some episodes of First Fuel are broadcast as they're recorded, so you can jump on Zoom and listen in live. For a full listing of upcoming recording times, visit eec.org.au/podcasts. But for now, it's goodbye from us, and we'll catch you soon.